Plessy versus Ferguson was the famous Supreme Court decision that determined separate is not equal. Yet Erica George, a College of Law professor at the University of Utah, says we still see separation and segregation throughout our society. So how can this be, she asks.
That's the kernel of institutional systemic racism. And when we speak about institutional racism, we're talking about what exists in institutions and organizations that continue to replicate exclusion that has been historic. So to put this another way, it's possible to think about having racism without racists, because we will have systematic exclusion based on principles or factors that arguably are not overtly racist.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a conversation about systemic racism, its impact on the community, and what can be done to overcome it. That's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're bringing you a panel discussion recorded recently at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah about systemic racism and its impact on the community. The discussion is focused on what is systemic racism, where can we see it or feel it in our workplaces, our education systems, or in our criminal justice systems, and importantly, what can be done about it? How can it be overcome? Much of this discussion is in some ways guided by the work of Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. She's currently the president of Spelman College, and she's the author of Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race, which examines why Americans are reluctant to talk about the touchy issues of race and what must be done to consider the psychological effects of racial identity and development. The panelists in this conversation include Kilo Zamora. He's the chair for the Salt Lake City Human Rights Commission. Also, Erica George, a professor at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. Alexis Baker, she's an undergraduate student at the University of Utah and also president of the Black Student Union. Maria Ledesma is a College of Education assistant professor. And the discussion is moderated by Francie Taylor, director of the American Indian Resource Center.
Welcome to the 2007 Campus and Community Panel discussion. We live it, we breathe it, the discussion of systemic racism. I am Kasawasit Kitapaha Sukiskwayo, or as I'm also known, Francie Taylor, the Executive Director of the American Indian Resource Center here at the University of Utah, and I will be the moderator for today's panel. I hope everyone had the opportunity to hear the MLK keynote speaker yesterday, who laid out the historic implications of systemic racism and how slavery laid the foundations for the systems we continue to be negatively impacted by to this day. Indeed, we live in uncertain times. And as Joe Fagan said, each major part of U.S. society, the economic, political, education, religion, and family reflects the fundamental reality of systemic racism. Much of what we're going to talk about today is based on the works of Dr. Beverly David Daniel Tatum. And so systemic racism is intersecting, overlapping, fundamental to the behaviors and institutional realities that have not diminished since the colonization of this country. Scholars such as Fagan, Frederick Douglass, Fenton, Cooper, Collins, and so many more have provided over 100 years of solid research and documentation on the ongoing reality of the implications of systemic racism. The panel today is going to be asked to explore the ways in which these historic systems are manifested and ways we can achieve more fundamental and systemic levels of change. So, panel, our first question, and please introduce yourself and tell us some little a bit about your work and your background, and how have you personally seen or experienced systemic racism in your academic careers? And we'll start with Kilo.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kilo Zamora, and my academic career is kind of short. I've been teaching as an adjunct teacher at the University of Utah for about one decade in about five different colleges here, all in the areas of social justice. But this is not my professional career. My professional career is doing social justice work in community. So I've spent my lifetime since I was 17 years old, in one way or the other, working on developing processes that reduce prejudice in our community and work towards systemic change. But when, as the question started to come to me, and all with inside of this context of Beverly Tatum's work, you might want to go back to 1997, 20 years ago, and think about her original question, which is, why are all the black kids sitting in the cafeteria together? In 1997, I was working for the Inclusion Center for Community and Justice, and we were also asking that same questions, but in a broader sense about why was there so much segregation occurring for all kinds of different groups. And one of the schools that we were looking at directly was West High School. And there, what we were doing is implementing programs that were bringing young people together to start having conversations and dialogues. But as we continued to have those conversations, we'd get a sprinkling of faculty members that would show up. And then we'd start that conversation together. But as we moved the conversation from young people to discuss what was going on and why there was segregation occurring at the cafeteria, we were following Tatum's work, and we were coming to some of her same conclusions. And the conclusions we were coming to is that as you move further up the power base, that question is not being asked. So as we were asking it, it seemed like it was getting more hostile. And the hostility was really a commentary on why hadn't it been asked before, and why don't we have practice and procedure in place that looks at why there's a complacency to how we segregate community. And when we segregate, then we go back to some older laws, Plessy versus Ferguson, for example, about how separate doesn't make equal. It actually makes a discrepancy in our resources. So moving forward, we're now 20 years later, and Tatum is coming out with her next book, and it's about why are the black kids sitting in the cafeteria still? And it's readdressing the same questions over and over again. The same thing that Dr. Taylor brought up, that we're looking at over 100 years of research that examines the same question about making the case, A, that systemic racism is real, and B, how does it affect students on an everyday basis inside of the academic arena? So in my classrooms, one of the first things that I'm noticing, regardless of which age the student's coming in with, is that students haven't been defining racism very well, nor all the way up to the master's level of social work have they had an accurate history of our nation. So we're having to use Takaki's books on history in master's level classes at the School of Social Work to begin to give them a foundation to even understand how much of our world has been built on the backs of exploited labor, to even start the conversation of what is systemic racism. So that's the beginning of my answer, and I'll pass the time over.
Okay. Hi, my name is Erica George. I'm a professor of law next door at the New Law School. I've been on campus 13 years, and I am the new Samuel L. Thurman Professor of Law. It's a thing in academia. So my background is international human rights law. I also teach U.S. constitutional law, but human rights law has similar sorts of questions, which is ultimately, in what ways can law help protect human dignity? And one of the fundamental things we accept is that all human beings are equal. And if we're having a serious conversation about systemic racism, we need to understand why it is and what it is. So being a lawyer, I'm going to just go through some definitions and typology. And I want to talk about the ways in which I think I can answer that question, why are black students still sitting together alone at the tables? What struck me in Kilo's remarks before I do this typology is it didn't surprise me necessarily that question isn't being asked, why are all the black kids sitting together in the lunch counter or lunch tables? Because I'm not sure how many black upper administrators she would have at some of these institutions, which will get me back to how systems are structured and how institutions and who populate them can help, in some instances, begin challenging questions of institutions. But we have to start at the beginning, which is individual. Racism can exist at an individual level, an institutional level, a societal level, and arguably a global level. In international human rights law, we're deeply concerned about something called genocide, which is the ultimate crime against humanity, which is the extermination of an entire class or population of people, right? So in its worst rendition, we have Holocausts, we have genocides. Before we even get to that stage, we have our interactions as individuals. So as an individual, we may be overtly racist. I don't like person X because she looks a different way. Or I might have covert racism where I'm not express about what my prejudices are. Or I may not even know that I hold prejudices at the individual level. At an institutional level, rarely do we see things anymore that are covert. Plessy versus Ferguson was a famous US court decision where we decided as a nation that under law, separate is not equal. And yet we see separation and segregation throughout our society. So how can this be? We have a legal system that expressly tells us that is not to be, and yet it is. That's the kernel of institutional systemic racism. And when we speak about institutional racism, we're talking about what exists in institutions and organizations that continue to replicate exclusion that has been historic. So to put this another way, it's possible to think about having racism without racists, because we will have systematic exclusion based on principles or factors that arguably are not overtly racist. So there's a case I like to teach my students that speaks to this, and I think it's interesting for our current moment. In the 1970s, police officer applicants in Washington, D.C. sued because there weren't black police officers being hired, there weren't black police officers being promoted. What the condition of a promotion and employment was a test or an exam. And disproportionately, black officer applicants weren't passing this exam. So the District of Columbia says, you know, we have this exam to ensure that people are qualified. You're not qualified, you haven't passed the test. Which, looking at it in one snapshot of time, you've passed, you've not passed the classification of the test. But if you looked at disproportionately who was not able to succeed and where they came from, a segregated school system that didn't have equal access to the same type of education, it wouldn't be surprising that you would not pass this exam. So then the question became, does the state have to look to what the implications are of having a neutral rule that's disproportionately going to impact or exclude a particular racial group? And the answer to that question is no. So long as we're neutral on the face of what our categorizations are, then we're not going to see that as race-based or racism or even problematic. And the problem persists. We have police departments that are not necessarily representative of the communities that they serve. In writing that decision, the United States Supreme Court was cognizant of the question because it was asked by the plaintiffs, are we really going to be satisfied with having a systemic exclusion, or should we be answering and asking these questions? And the court says no, because if we ask that, we would have to ask about schools, we would have to ask about virtually everything in society and interrogate the way things look. So the unwillingness to do that at that point in time and now gives us a reason why society looks as it does. So the court says, look, if in practice it benefits or burdens one race more than another, if we looked into everything, it would be far-reaching. It would raise serious questions and perhaps invalidate a whole range of things, like tax or welfare or public services or licensing statutes, just because something is more burdensome to the poor and to the average black man to the more affluent white. That's not going to be a suspect class that we concern ourselves with as a constitutional matter of equal protection. So I think that speaks volumes to what is seen as serious and what is seen as problematic. This case is now over 30 years old. If you're following the court, you know that there aren't the votes to overturn this kind of precedent, and there probably won't be in the near future. But I think it helps help us understand why things look the way they are. And if the right people aren't asking questions and well-positioned to make change, whether that's a person of color or a person of consciousness, things continue to look largely as they are in different sectors of society and even in the schools that we're in.
Hey, how are y'all doing? Okay, so my name is Alexis Baker, and I am a student here at the University of Utah. I'm studying health promotion and working towards a minor in African American studies. And I'm also the BSU president here at the university as well. And so the question was asked, have you seen any forms of systemic racism, or have you experienced it? And so how I can answer that question is, how many of y'all know where Layton is? Anybody? Okay, so a few of y'all. So you know out there there's nothing, it's all white folks, it's very conservative area, and so that's where I grew up. I can remember a lot of accounts of blatant racism that I've experienced, as far as the N-word being written across pictures that I posted in classrooms and things like that. And then also I'm actually working in Layton for the Village, initiative, and I'm back in the schools over there, and some of the students are still having these same issues of being called the N-word in the halls, and then they bring it up to their teachers and nothing's being done. And so how that can relate back to systemic racism is that I think that school boards are taking more of a reactive approach rather than a proactive approach, meaning that they're not educating their kids on why this is wrong. They're just saying, we have no tolerance for this. This doesn't happen. I'm sorry this happened to you. But then students are still feeling the same way time and time again. And I was in middle school long time ago, and just to see that still happening, that just shows that there's still a problem within the system that hasn't been addressed.
Hi, everyone. My name is Maria Ledesma, and I am an assistant professor in educational leadership and policy in the College of Education. This is year 7 for me. There's a big plus and a minus in going last, because I'm I want to come in on that, But in terms of starting off just personally, I'm a first-generation college graduate. I am someone who was able to go to college because of the existence of race-conscious affirmative action practices. And so that informs the work I do. When I teach my students, we often talk about research being me-search, right? That it's very much connected to who you are, what you do. And in the span of my both education and career, this is an area that I have consistently come back to. As a doctoral student, I was able to study with people who are foundational to establishing critical race theory in education. And so this is a theory that I have adopted for myself as well in my own work. And one of the tenets of critical race theory is the recognition that race and racism are real, indelible, they're part of everyday life. And part of the work of also critical race theorists is they look at the work of past scholars, including the work of psychologist Dr. Chester Pierce, who talked about racial microaggressions. And one of the things that Dr. Pierce said very early on in the 70s is he framed racism as a symptom and white supremacy as a disease. And I think one of the things that we need to do when we talk about this is, again, talk about the larger context, about racism and how we see that manifested, but also the larger context and backdrop within which it exists and within which this nation was founded. So personally for myself, how I have seen this is through a myriad of ways, personally, but as I reflected in terms of what to share with you, one of the things I thought about was that fresh out of college, I went to UC Berkeley for my undergrad, and I kind of didn't know what path I was going to go on to yet, so I decided to work for a local education nonprofit. And when I did that, I was placed in a city not too far from where I grew up. I grew up in Oakland, but I worked with an elementary school in Hayward, which was just further south of Oakland, and I got to be there 4 days a week, and I got to work with parents, families at large, students, teachers, community members, And you know, through a number of different programs and projects, I did this for 2 years, after which I decided that I was going to transition more to looking at higher ed, and I actually went to work at Cal. There, I lasted maybe a year before I decided I'm going to go and get my master's. And when I came back from having my master's, I went back to my alma mater, to Berkeley, and at that point, I wanted to work in outreach. Outreach is something that's near and dear to my heart, so I went to work for Berkeley's Equal Education, or no, what is that? Early Academic Outreach Program. I was trying to think of the acronym, EAOP. And coincidentally enough, I was placed back in Hayward, and now I got to see some of the students that I had met as elementary school students. I now saw them further down their education pipeline. And it was both rewarding and disheartening to see how some of these students had been tracked away from college prep, and how now, you know, some of these students were doing amazingly well. And, you know, having met them as elementary school students, they were just very sharp and bright, and I think, you know, still very full of hope and energy. And then having, you know, to see them as high schoolers, where that kind of flame had been extinguished, was really disheartening. And, you know, for some of these students, I actually got to see them go on, you know, to college. But, you know, one of the things that was most telling was to see who was tracked away. And I will forever remember that, you know, one of these students that I just thought was such a loss was a young man of color. And he was just so smart as an elementary school student, and I'm sure that didn't change, but how he was supported or not is what changed. So I think that for me was one of the things that struck me. Now just to again, comment real quick, as a critical race theorist in education, you look to the work of scholars like William Tate and Gloria Latson Billings, and she has a very provocative piece that is entitled, Can We at Least Have Plessy? That talks about, can we at least have that separate that is equal? And we're not there yet.
That's Maria Ledesma. She's a College of Education assistant professor at the University of Utah, speaking recently as part of a panel discussion about systemic racism. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we replay them, unedited, in their entirety, as a public service. And today we are airing a forum recorded on January 19th, addressing the issue of systemic racism. The panelists seek not only to explain what is systemic racism, but where it is seen or felt, and the impact it has on our community here locally in Utah, and how it can be overcome. The panelists include Kilo Zamora, he's the chair of the Salt Lake City Human Rights Commission, Erica George, she's a professor of law at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, Alexis Baker, she's an undergraduate student and the president of the Black Student Union, and Maria Ledesma, she's an assistant professor at the College of Education. And the discussion is moderated by Francie Taylor. She is the director of the American Indian Resource Center.
So with the thought of those that have gone before us, with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Lewis and others, what can we learn from past activism and social movements to resist current problems that impact all people of color today?
Just talking off the top of my head, I recently became familiar with a figure called Fred Hampton. How many in this room have heard of this gentleman? Okay, very few, and that makes me feel somewhat comforted because I'm a native Chicagoan, and he was actually assassinated in Chicago by the police, as it turns out. But before that happened, what he was committed to was building a multiracial justice movement. So unlike King or Malcolm X, he was this wave of conversation about, look, the same kinds of concerns you have are actually my concerns. had that come to fruition, I like to imagine that what he may have put into practice is an understanding of interest convergence, that it is the interest not just of people of color, but I guess people of non-color or white people as well, to identify that there are common interests on top of our common humanity that perhaps can be advanced that would be to the benefit of all. The legal scholar, who's a critical race theorist that my education colleagues will be familiar with, who was the birth of our field in law, looking at critical race theory in law, where is race showing up or not in these decisions, was a man named Derrick Bell. He was also the first African-American tenured professor at Harvard Law School before he left in protest because there were not people coming behind him. There was the one, there was him and a token, and he didn't feel like he should take that. He left and went to another legal institution, and in his time he wrote a number of books. One of his central theories was that there is no racial justice or racial progress in this country unless it comes with interest convergence, or put another way, less charitably, if it's not in the interest of the white power majority, it is not going to happen. And those interests may shift and change over time due to geopolitics. We don't want to look bad on the international stage, so we can't keep putting fire hoses and dogs on unarmed people in Selma and the Deep South, or it may be broader economic factors, or people rising in consciousness, rising to power. But there's always pressure, and ultimately it does have to meet more than the needs of people of color communities. As a young person, when I read this, I was actually rather distressed and thought it was depressing and not forward-looking. But it's pragmatic politics and something that seemed to be being pushed forward. I think it's highly ironic that Fred Hampton, who had this rainbow view of what social justice should look like, had his life cut short so quickly. So I think, particularly as the United States becomes more multiracial, more biracial, as there is more mixing, at least somewhat socially, we've got to figure out a way to have a future conversation that has a place for everyone to speak in it, not overshouting another person's voice, being able to listen respectably, but respectfully, but finding common cause and common concern. So,
yeah, you know, this is a tough one for me because this is where I spend most of my days. I'm working in these movements, and I find them to be messy, and I find times when I want to use the master's tools, and I do. Meaning that there are times in which I see opportunities in our movements where if I dominate a little bit harder, if I play the game, that I can see policy passed. And that just becomes reality. When I'm working up at the Capitol, and sometimes I have to say, right now I'm in a new place where I'm thinking about the hate crimes legislation. Because it's about to come back up at the Capitol. And I was a part of the first movement here in Utah to get that sucker passed. And two things that were interesting to me. Number one is when it got passed the first time, one group that we left out was gender identity. And we knew it. Partially, we didn't understand it as a group, as a collective. But second, we had put all of our chips on ensuring that we had LGB in there, not the T, the LGB part of it, in the hate crimes law. But fast forwarding, now I'm looking at what's happening with Black Lives Matters, and I'm realizing we're investing in a militarization of our police departments. And hate crimes legislation allows for more opportunities to invest in that. Because the last time I looked into our prisons and our criminal justice system, I saw people of color as the primary victims. So why did I put so much emphasis and political stock into a hate crime legislation that only bolsters our criminal justice programs at that time? And I have to say, that's why it's messy. That as I'm moving on these movements, I'm learning about how to not only progress myself, but realizing how I've even misunderstood where I should be going. And now that the new one's coming up, I have to tell you, I'm going to find myself on the opposite side of a lot of my closest and dearest friends of color who have been doing this work for a long time, because I don't think we're ready to invest more money into that system yet. until we have some honest conversations about the ways in which we continue to participate in systemic racism, which is about how we target human beings based on their racial categorizations. And this is not just about an attitude that's happening on an implicit bias from our police officers, it's a lot broader conversation. So when I think about lessons to be learned, I think the first lesson for me is from the past that I try to bring back into the future, is there's some humility for me to have. And I just can't emphasize that enough. And willing to call myself out about things that I participated. I think actions that I participated in the past, which I thought my heart and head were in the right place to go forward with, but in reality, I might have been about making it worse and trying to find some corrections to that. And the second thing that I think we can learn from the past is that in King's work, he continued to leave out our LGBT community. And we're now in a place now where we're trying to open ourselves up to have some more fluid identities across lots of spectrums and allowing us to open our movements to bring in more folks into these conversations. Those are two of 1,000 lessons I've learned. And I just, maybe last, what it all says for me is, I've never been right. And I don't think I'm ever going to be. But I'm gonna still get up and try to make a difference, which whatever that means.
I think that just like back in the day, you know, like all it takes is one person or one group of people to spark a movement at least. And I think that same idea applies today, except now we have social media, right? So like it takes a video, a hashtag, mm-hmm. a post to spark a movement. And so just like back then to now, all it takes is just one person to speak up for everyone else around you to wake up and be like, hey, like that's kind of wrong. And so I think that's one thing we can take from the past.
I think as I think about this, one of the things that comes most to mind is that these movements occurred in fits and starts. It didn't just come together and poof happen. You know, there was a lot of growing pain. And one of the things that I think we can learn from the past and hopefully remember to apply now is to avoid the oppression Olympics, right? Who's the most oppressed? And instead, remember who holds the biggest piece of the pie and how that pie is unequally distributed, period. But definitely, I think I echo what Alexis says in terms of looking to those past movements for inspiration and motivation, the Civil Rights Act, the women's movement, the Stonewall Rebellion, that all of those were a group of dedicated people that came together to make social change. But again, it didn't happen overnight. There was a lot of hard work that needs to be put in.
Such a process. I also grew up foundational work with Paulo Ferrari and struggle with how do we change from outside if we don't use the master's tools. So following up on that, how do we integrate the use of policy work and grassroots activism to dismantle systems of racism that continue to exist?
So that's a very complex question, and it could be out of my realm because I don't work in policy or anything like that. But what I can say is that you can't have one without the other, so you need people in the system and people with that outside of the system to make a movement effective. So,
just really quickly, a lot of policies that are short of law, like a policy commitment that your local school board makes or a policy commitment the university makes, those who want to enforce it sometimes need help in enforcing it. And the more that there are social actors who can amplify the voices of, yes, this is something that is needed, yes, this is something we're committed to, the further we'll get in actually having policies realized, presuming that we have positive policies and good ones in place. Where they are harmful. It's important to show who they injure, who they burden, who benefits, and how the broader community may be benefited by, say, disrupting a prison-to-school pipeline or school-to-prison pipeline. So finding what impacts your daily life and what the policies, rules, and structures are that make it so, and beginning to contest that, talk about it. I love this, it takes a video. You used to say it takes a village, but I guess your video gets to your online community village. But the way policy and grassroots activism can interact is helping to change negative policies and helping to ensure that positive policies are developed and implemented and get the continued commitment, support, funding that they need to grow and flourish.
So I started my work off really doing dialogues in communities about prejudice reduction and getting real conversations going about how our prejudice is affecting us, how our values impact us, and allowing for some of our more basic ideas of sexism and racism and classism to kind of come up to the surface and then start dealing with them as a community. And that was tough work on me, and it seemed like every time I would go out and do one of these conversations, I would come home extremely wounded. Because you hear stories of people who remind you of your grandmother, or your daughter, or your sister, or a friend. And right now, we're looking at how that's not enough, that those dialogues just don't happen alone. There has to be some policy attached to them. And vice versa, just having policy without the dialogue, they become shallow. That we still have implementers that have to implement these things. And one that I just want to bring up, lift up right now, is there are a lot of folks in Utah who are gathering under Racially Justice Utah. It's just a nonprofit, volunteer folks who are trying to influence the cradle to prison pipeline. And they're actually going to have a symposium here in the S.J. Quinney College on February 11th. And it's I would encourage you all to participate. It's called Breaking the Pipeline Symposium. And we did the first symposium last year. This is number two. But it's about bringing policymakers together. It's about bringing activists together. It's about bringing academics together. It's about bringing community folks together, police force together, and start to talk about how all of these components, like, they fit. And how do we disrupt a pipeline that's being built that tracks kids of color straight from the cradle to the prison? And it's if one of these groups said they had the answer, I would have to say baloney. Because somehow it's about how they all fit together. Our families fit together, with our local politicians fit together, with our state and federal politicians, how our educators fit together in this, how our children are a part of these conversations, and how our academic community helps inform some of the research that we need to put it all into one larger recipe. That's tough. And you know what we're touting it as right now is collective impact. But I'm disagreeing with that. I think that without having some critical race theory, without having some intersectionality conversations, collective impact is shallow. So we need folks like some of the academics in this room, some of the scholars, all of you participating in how we have these more deeper and broader conversations about how we make policy change in our state. And I think that there's no magic bullet, and we're all recognizing that and trying to find ways to make that change.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just tuning in today, we are airing a panel discussion about systemic racism. What is it? How is it experienced in our private or public spheres, or in our educational or criminal justice systems? And how does it hurt our community? And what actions could be taken to address it and overcome it? The panelists include Kilo Zamora. He's the chair of the Salt Lake City Human Rights Commission. Erica George is a College of Law professor at the University of Utah. Alexis Baker is an undergraduate student and the president of the Black Student Union. And Maria Ledesma is an assistant professor of the College of Education at the University of Utah. And the discussion is moderated by Francie Taylor. She is the director of the American Indian Resource Center. Here's Francie.
Trying to leave some time here for some questions and answers. So we have lots of negative things we can focus on right now. There's lots of things out there that are consuming my midnight hours and wakeless night or sleepless nights. So let's try to end on a tiny bit of positivity. And so I'm going to ask the panel to briefly mention something that you've seen in the past few months that allows us to have hope.
Well, you may have heard that there's this little march going on in D.C. Mm-hmm. on Saturday. I think that is evident of being on a cusp of a resurgence of social and political activism, that in lieu of, you know, an administration change that many people may not be pleased with, is actually motivating people to speak their voice and their mind. And so I think that that's something that's very positive. I think that the one of the things that I also thought about is also movements like the Dreamer movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, that although the reason that those movements came into existence were because of very real and immense challenges, that the fact that those movements exist are also very inspirational and positive.
So just relating back to what you said, yeah, it is hard to see hope after the election and our new president-elect. But I do think that there is a silver lining in that, and that being that people are beginning to wake up and seeing that there are injustices in our country, and they're beginning to call people out on that. And it is sparking change, and it is allowing people to open their eyes to what's actually going on.
I'm also interested and encouraged by the social movements that are emerging. You told me to stay positive, so I'll come back to it. But I don't know what happened to the Occupy movement, for example, right? And I worry that the Dreamers and Black Lives Matter may also kind of be a flash in the pan. So again, I would emphasize connecting the marching and protests in the street to a cogent, pragmatic policy aim. But again, legal orientation, I'd like to see more of that. To the extent that that conversation starts to happen, I'd be encouraged. One thing that I find fascinating, some of my work is global human trafficking. For ages, that was a taboo topic. The people involved, even those who were trafficked, were called illegals or prostitutes. Now there's this conversation that's reframed them as survivors, as potential collaborators in ending injustices. And it's been interesting to see lawyers on different sides of the political spectrum, from the right to the left, being able to come together around concern for what is modern slavery. So seeing these concepts being reinvented in a way that they can be heard by law enforcement entities that had previously criminalized a particular identity group is encouraging and interesting, and I think some small space to begin to make some changes about how they think about law enforcement and who partners are and who needs to be at the table to solve this particular problem. So if we could model in other realms that kind of conduct, I think that could be constructive. So that's potentially positive.
I see it everywhere. I mean, I see a lot of negative, but it doesn't come without seeing a ton of positivity occurring all over this whole planet. I'm encouraged by the new designation of Bears Ears Monument. Yeah. I'm encouraged that we saw our local tribes coming together to organize to create some sovereignty of their own and express that, and to have a president support that. I'm just as encouraged by the way that our Indigenous people and allies are doing their work in North Dakota right now. And I'm encouraged to see the ways in which I haven't seen in my lifetime American Indians organizing and deciding and making a destiny for themselves, and that we're finding ways to finally support that work in deeper and broader ways. I'm encouraged by that. I'm encouraged by this campus, by last year's town hall meeting that we had. And if you, back in 2015 now, when we began to see students share what they think they wanted to see changed here. And I'm encouraged by the way that Dr. Stockton and her colleagues have come around the table to all of our groups and shared how they're holding themselves accountable to what those students wanted here on this campus. And finally, I'm encouraged by the way that students are having conversations on this campus, at least in my classrooms, and what they're talking about. And what I'm encouraged about is their ability to be more flexible with allowing more types of conversations to be had and not allow dogma to rule their lives. So I'm encouraged by all of that, and I believe that's a backdrop to what's to come into the future. So I just see a lot happening.
And I'm going to allow myself to answer that question too. I'm encouraged to be at the University of Utah at this particular time. It has been a profound benefit and joy to be able to work with people like Estella and Neelam, who have worked endlessly on this week's MLK with Dr. Stockton and all of my colleagues on this panel, that you have these resources at your fingertips here at the university should make you all hopeful and share a lot of positive joy and work towards the future. So with that, I'd like to open it up for some questions from the audience. I do want to remind you that this is being broadcast on the radio, so please wait until you have the mic in your hand before you start speaking, and please frame these as questions, not statements.
So at a college and being a lot of students here, my question is, a lot of universities are race conscious. They look at race with applications. Should that continue? And is it a problem that universities and the institutes recognize racism? Or could that be recognized as racism?
Sorry, so in answer to that question, I've served on the admissions committees at the University of Utah at the law school. There are two governing cases that are relevant to the question of race in college admissions. Well, three. There's the University of Michigan cases, Grutter and Gratz, and then there's Fisher. What is the case is race is never outcome determinative in an application. So when we look at race, it's a combination of factors. It's not a number, it's not a quota. It is if the applicant chooses to self-identify and express how that experience is relevant to their educational achievement, lack thereof, what they plan to attain, then it becomes relevant as a matter of whether or not it adds diversity to our class. And diversity counts on many scales. So that could be language diversity, it could be gender diversity, it could be the diversity of being a veteran or a descendant of a University of Utah graduate. So far from it being racism, it's one of several factors. I don't know that we would say it would be veteransism or sexism. And there is a misperception, if you don't read the cases and you read the popular media reporting on it, of what race can be used for and when. So we can have race-conscious policies. There's a portion of the Supreme Court that thinks everything should be colorblind. There's another portion of the Supreme Court that recognizes that race exists, racism is real, and one of the things that institutions should be cognizant of is a past history of racism. Actually, the law doesn't say that. We could not care that there was a history of slavery, but what we do care about is having a diverse academic environment where the academic freedom of the institution is to craft the classrooms that they want, which arguably, for the purposes of advancing educational gains, is not served by having a classroom of clones. So when we look at any application, we look at what they're going to bring, what they're going to contribute, we look at race, and we look beyond it. And as I look at the University of Utah, I'm not terribly worried that we're being extremely racist in admitting the very few people of color that we do have here. So it's something that most universities that are public institutions continue to work on and work towards, but we do it within the confines of what the legal requirements are.
So I definitely echo everything that's been said, but I guess I would also just add that at no point does the consideration of race as one single factor override qualifications.
So it can never be outcome determinative.
Right. So the student who applies has to meet all of the qualifications to be considered for admission, period. And I think that, again, that is one of the ongoing misconceptions that exist around this particular debate.
Thank you. In our list of isms that we suffer from in our society and the systemic racism, systemic sexism, homophobia, all those things, what role do you see class playing as a root of all of those systems? I know that was a...
No, it's okay.
That's a good conversation.
I go back and forth. I mean, I've been in the room with some extremely talented economists who want to say that classism is at the heart of all of these isms. And, you know, and I've been convinced. And then I've gone back to looking at the ways that that a pipeline of intersectionality of being male and African American are bigger determinants of getting to prison. And then I go back to why there's an erosion of public school systems. And the argument seems maybe it's class-based, that there's an erosion of public school systems. There should be more choice. And in fact, our new president-elect Trump's new Secretary for Education is nominee, thank you, actually believes in some erosion of the public system by creating more choice. And so then it looks like it's a class topic. But then I have to go back again and say, well, why are all the black kids sitting in the cafeteria together? So my point is that I just think that they're connected. I believe it's intersectional. I believe what the fallacy is that when we say that one of them is bigger than the other, and the fallacy is when we start to work on just one of them, but we do not factor in the others. Is classism a problem? Absolutely. And when we talk about racism without it, we don't do it justice. So I feel like I'm somewhere between them all, and I believe there's a lot of bright folks who just spend their time in one of those, and they kind of get me over a little bit. But I always come back to think that there's an intersectional weaving that's occurring, and that's what's affecting a larger portion of us.
I think that intersectionality is right on point. It's very important. But I want to remind us of our outgoing president and the reason he was targeted, and the reason that, you know, from very early on, he was the president with one of the highest death threats, right? That's why he had to have early security. And the reason that, you know, in the initial State of the Unions that he was given, there was outburst and just a continual just pattern of disrespect was not because of his class. And I think they're both and often, but I think race is unique and we need to remember.
Hi. So you guys were talking about dialogue and policy. So I'm just curious, how and where can we change those harmful policies?
Let me just put in a plug for participating in your political process and voting from every level, state and local to school board, or even in the institution that you were in. There are committees on this campus, students can serve on them, and we make policy that governs this university. So ASUU, right, the student orgs could be better organized about figuring out what are the policies that impact what this classroom looks like, what my financial aid looks like, what the university invests in or doesn't invest in. I've chaired university committees. We always have students on those committees with varying levels of participation. So getting involved and getting networked into the people who are making decisions or able to influence decisions. A sad note on your class question, actually under constitutional law, we don't consider class to be a suspect classification. Suspect classifications are those that you cannot change easily. So my race is more suspect than my class. I could be born poor, but we still believe that tomorrow I could be rich. So that's something that can change. And we're just not as interested in devoting the legal, political resources to interrogating these questions of intersectionality, which makes it a little difficult when law and policy don't quite match up with the reality of the lived experiences of people who may be poor and black or rich and Asian or how that goes. So.
Well, we're going to wrap up this discussion here because of time, but you can hear this full discussion about systemic racism on our website, kcpw.org, or in the podcast version of this show. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.